Season 7, Episode 28 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we'll have more interesting content and we'll read your feedback. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat thing on the website and in the #UPC IRC channel. I'm Mark, and joining me this week, the A-team back together, Alan.
Hello.
Laura.
Hello.
And Tony.
Good evening.
So, Alan,
yes.
What have you been up to since?
I went to Manchester.
Oh, what did you do that for?
I went there because we were sponsoring an event, XDA DevCon 2014, which is a conference for organized by the XDA developers website, community, that's the word. And we sponsored it and sent three of us, myself, Daniel Hoback, and a guy called Andre from the, whose surname I can never pronounce.
Is it The Giant?
No. And we gave talks, and it's a bit like OgCamp, although without it being an unconference, it's all scheduled talks. There's a couple of little slots where they had like lightning kind of talks, and there was like a panel at the end of the first night and stuff. But it was all very phone and device oriented. After each of the talks, they were like, you know, is there any questions? And you got rewarded if you asked a good question with free stuff. Mm. And they were like giving away all kinds of stuff, from phone covers to actual phones and tablets, Pebble watches.
Wow.
You know, all kind of, what they've done is all the sponsors have basically given them stuff and or money, and they use that as, you know, prizes. And it really triggered, like, you know, people to ask sensible questions because there's the possibility they might win something.
Yeah. Cool.
And
did you win anything?
Yes, I did. I won a Bluetooth speaker, which was quite cool.
Are we giving away phones at OgCamp? Did we give away phones at OgCamp?
No, we didn't.
Oh.
And they also have a raffle where you don't have to pay for the tickets.
What?
I know.
Madness.
I know. Heresy. It's an economic model that
that's not a raffle.
It can't possibly be sustained. I know.
They
also
have a lot of sponsorship.
Yeah, they do. They had Nvidia and Sony and Oppo and loads of other big people there. Wow. And us.
Cool.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough.
Laura, what have you been doing?
I went to OgCamp.
Cool.
Ah.
Tell us about it. What was your favourite bit?
My favourite bit was...
Was it when Alan did that thing
that
on
thing,
the Saturday
yeah.
night?
You yeah.
I want to know. I was there and you weren't there at all.
Who'd have thought he'd have worn that outfit, though?
So, yeah, no, it was
weekends.
Great fun.
Brilliant.
Everybody else has missed it.
Well,
you missed out.
It's all gone.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Tony, have you been, up to anything much?
Yeah, well, I have been on my long-awaited trip to Malawi.
You went to Malawi?
Yeah.
I don't think you mentioned it.
No, well, I was gone for a while. Did you not notice I was not here for six episodes?
Yeah, we did notice that, but we thought you just got
that.
Bored and wandered off.
Wow.
So, so I went, and thank you very much to everybody who sponsored me to go there. Lots of podcast listeners and
not enough to
people.
Keep you there, though.
it was a very...
You try to have a whip round while you're out.
It was a very exhausting experience, but very worthwhile. And it was very hard work climbing the mountain. But yeah, back safe and sound on English soil.
What were the biggest things you learned while you were there?
Some crazy things, like people in the village that we stayed in have to walk 2 days to get to a clinic.
Wow.
So like, if you stub your toe, it's a long way to go. And people just die on their way to the clinics.
Wow.
Because you went out there on a medical trip, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was, well, it was a mixture of things, but medical was part of it, yes. So that was definitely a big interest. Some really kind of, we went to a district hospital, had 450 beds and one doctor.
Ooh.
Yeah, life's very different out there. Mm. So it was a bit of a shock coming back to the UK, but I've got used to it now.
Golly.
Yeah, but it really was an amazing trip. So
are you
thank
going
you very
to
much.
Blog about it and put photos and stuff?
Probably in due course. I need to kind of go through all the photos and process everything.
You didn't take any wedding photos while you're out there?
No. Although, you know, pleasingly...
Do you do wedding photos?
I do, yeah. So I'm taking bookings for 2015. if anybody's interested or knows anybody's getting married, yeah, give us a shout. That'd be great. Mark, what about you?
I have been doing a bit of moonlighting on the Linux Voice podcast.
Ooh.
Linux Voice, of course, sponsors of OgCamp this year.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. sponsor.
Thank you. They did sponsor OddCamp, and they were in the exhibition as well.
Yay!
They're yeah.
very
chaps,
popular guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Assuming
what were you?
The...
What were you on Linux Voice for?
I was just
how dare you
chatting about this podcast and about OddCamp.
Wicked.
Excellent. Yes.
Excellent. Well, well done.
Should we get on with it?
Andy Stanford Clark, Master Inventor and Distinguished Engineer at IBM, came to talk at OddCamp, and he was telling us about his HiPi project. So for people who weren't there and who were listening to the show, he's agreed to come and explain a bit about it. So, hello Andy.
Hi Laura.
First of all, what is the HiPi?
So the HiPi stands for the Hydrogen Pi, and it's a hydrogen fuel cell powered Raspberry Pi.
And you use it for what?
So for the thing I'm using it for here, I'm actually using it to present my presentation about the HiPi. So it's highly recursive. So it's the Hydrogen Pi boots up, and it has a script which looks for a PDF file, opens that in presentation mode. And so all being well, after a brief introduction and all the booting up of the Raspberry Pi coming up, it pops up with the first slide.
So how much power does a Raspberry Pi need?
So Model B Raspberry Pi, there are three models, uses about 3 to 4 watts of power. And the fuel cell I've got produces up to 12 watts, so we've got ample power. In fact, at the OddCamp on Saturday, the HDMI Pi people asked if I could produce 10 watts in order to power their little HDMI LCD panel with a Raspberry Pi strapped to the back of it. I thought, oh yes, that'll be fun. So we went outside and did exactly that, and we got some lovely tweets and photos of the HDMI Pi being powered by hydrogen.
Oh, cool. So do you want to explain what the HiPi looks like if it were sitting here in front of you?
Yes, I guess it doesn't work too well on radio, but so we're looking at a Perspex sheet about 30 centimetres by 30 centimetres, and it's laid out, there's four quadrants to it. In the top left-hand corner, we've got two little cylinders of hydrogen. They're about the size of a lipstick, perhaps, or a massive AA battery. And each of those holds 10 litres of hydrogen, and that's produced using an electrolyzer, which is a box which you put water into the top of, distilled water, and you plug it into the electricity. It uses about 12 volts and 20 watts, so it uses quite a very low amount of electricity. That sticks pure hydrogen into these cylinders, and then you can then take them away from the electrolyzer and use them as if they're a battery of stored energy. And each cylinder holds about 12 AA batteries worth of power, so when it's converted back into electricity, it's about that number of amp hours of electricity.
So you just said there were 10 litres in one of the, and they are literally like a long lipstick sort of size.
Yeah, so it's a pressurised vessel, so they're stored at 30 bar, which for those of you who put air in your tyres, it's about 30 psi. It's about 400 psi, so it's pretty high pressure. And there's a little regulator on the end which takes it down from 30 bar down to 0.5 bar. So that's the pressure at which it goes into the fuel cell.
Okay, so keeping going around your Perspex sheet.
Okay, so then we've got some little thin plastic tubes, and they feed into the fuel cell, which is a little silver box about,
it kind of looks like a fan on a motherboard, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it looks like one of those massive heat sinks you get on a CPU, so it does remind me of that. So it's got a fan on top, and it's got air intakes on the side. It's got a little hole where the hydrogen goes in, and it's got a red and black terminal where the electricity comes out. So the principle of a fuel cell is you take hydrogen and oxygen, combine them over a catalyst, and that produces water in the form of steam and electricity, which comes out through the red and black terminals.
Okay. And then that's what you use then? You plug that then into the Raspberry Pi?
No, not quite. So the voltage that comes out of the fuel cell is quite unregulated, and you have to do a few little tricks to keep the fuel cell happy. You have to short out the terminals from time to time to balance the ions inside the stack. and you also have to release the pressure in the thing using a little valve which goes every 30 seconds or so, and people who saw it in action on the stage at Og Camp would have heard that little sound. So the voltage from the fuel cell feeds into a stack of three boards, bottom of which is an Arduino. The second one is a shield, which is made by Arcola Energy, which is the company that makes the fuel cell development kit that I based this system on. That does voltage and current monitoring, and also does the stack shorting and the control of the purge valve to let the pressure out. That doesn't quite do all the things I needed to do to run the Raspberry Pi comfortably. So I've built another board on top of it, which it looks a little bit sort of Heath Robinson. It's made with Vario board, turned into an Arduino shield. And it's got a couple of relays and a voltage regulator and a USB socket. So what that does is it completes the monitoring control of the fuel cell and produces a lovely stable 5.0 volt output on the USB port, which is then ready to power the Raspberry Pi.
And without that, what happens?
So if you don't have the controller, then you're running a very varying voltage as the fuel cell goes through its various machinations, anything between 7 volts and 12 volts. All of which would destroy the Raspberry Pi if you left it unchecked. But also the you have to make sure that when the pressure drops in the hydrogen, so when you either turn it off or if one of the cylinders runs out, that you don't accidentally leave the load connected to the fuel cell, because that can cause irreversible damage to it. So some of the electronics I added detects that situation and then opens a relay to make sure the fuel cell is protected as it runs down in its sort of shutdown mode.
And then it goes into the Raspberry Pi.
Yes, and finally it goes into the Raspberry Pi. So we've got a little 5-volt connector going into the micro USB to power up the Raspberry Pi. It's got the SD card in there. And when that boots up, as I said, its only purpose in life is to launch a PDF file in full screen mode, ready to present. And then if I plug my little clicker, my projection clicker, into the USB port, then I can just control the backwards and forwards movement of the slides and give my presentation.
Cool. And how long does it take to boot up when you're doing the presentation?
It seems like forever, but I've got the patter down now, so I'm explaining how the HiPi works and what the fuel cell is and what the little stick of hydrogen is and how I got this hydrogen from the electrolyzer. So once it takes about a minute to condition the fuel cell so that it's ready to power up the Pi. And then it's a normal Pi startup sequence, which is probably about 45 seconds, something like that. And the good news is that the projector springs into life and you start seeing all the Linux boot up messages scrolling up the screen. So everybody's getting really excited at that point because clearly something's happening and it's not just this heap of electronics is actually going to do something. And then there's a pause as the X window starts, and then boom, up comes the first slide. And normally everybody cheers at that point. And I have a big sigh of relief.
Has it worked every time?
Every time but one. I gave a talk to an internal presentation at IBM last week in London, and it booted up and everybody applauded, but then I couldn't click past the first slide. It seemed to be frozen somehow. And I think I've got to the bottom of it now because it hasn't happened since, and I've given that exact same presentation again and it worked perfectly. So never quite sure what happened to that one, but you could just turn it off and reboot it, but you've got to go through that whole 2 or 3 minutes then of basically waiting now because everybody knows what the story is, and so you've just got to kill the time. So doesn't work too well of a rapid restart. But I think I've got it finely tuned now, so I think I can whip it out of its travelling case, plug in the hydrogen stick, and be fairly confident as I'm starting my presentation that it's all going to work.
Okay, and so the hydrogen part itself, the power part of it, seems pretty reliable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The fuel cell starts every time. It's only the Raspberry Pi software that seemed to be causing a bit of problem. So that's one thing that's really impressed me, actually, is the fuel cell starts absolutely without fail every time. As soon as you connect the hydrogen, the fan starts, which is sucking the air in to get the oxygen it needs to mix with it. So it's completely self-powered. There's no battery or capacitor or anything in the fuel cell. It completely bootstraps itself, very literally.
So could somebody build this themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started off with a fuel cell development kit from Arcola Energy, which you can buy off the web. I'm sure we can put a link in the show notes. And that is the basis for the system. and the extensions to it that I've developed are going to be fed back into Arcola to put on the next rev of the board. The system is advertised as being open source development kit. Certainly on their webpage, there's a link to the GitHub for the Arduino code that runs the controls the fuel cell, and I think the plan is to make the hardware design open source, but I haven't actually found the link to that yet, but certainly that was their intention. So what they want is a community around this basic fuel cell development kit to use it for different applications, and I'm using it for projecting a presentation, but you might use it to design some kind of Internet of Things sensor, which, given a big enough hydrogen tank, could run for years and years without having to go back to maintain it. So a lot of interest in developing different applications for this system, and really driving the technology forward, because this is very early in the life cycle of hydrogen as a fuel, and so things like fuel cells these days are quite expensive, but obviously as more people use them, those prices will come down, and hopefully we'll see some perhaps one day we'll see a completely standalone hydrogen powered projection device that can actually do the projection as well as the actually generating the slides.
So what are the constraints on what this can power?
So the fuel cell that I've got is up to 12 watts, so at 5 volts, that's 2 and a bit amps. So you could power several Raspberry Pis, probably just about 3 Raspberry Pis. I've used it to power a USB fan for a demo, and really anything up to 12 watts. But you can also buy bigger fuel cells. The next model up is 30 watts. So if you wanted to run lots of Raspberry Pis or something a bit more substantial than a 30 watt device, and it's just it's DC voltage at, well, I use it at 5 volts, but you could run it at 7 volts, probably guaranteed, because the stack voltage varies between about 7 point something volts and 12 point something volts. But you can buy really big ones. Last time I visited Arcola Energy in London, they were building a 4 kilowatt fuel cell, which is about the size of a car radiator. Actually, looked rather like a car radiator, and that was going to go in the back of a vehicle to power it. So it was going to power, actually charge the batteries in an electric vehicle to make it go along.
Ah, cool. So is that different from previous hydrogen powered cars?
Ah, so there's two ways of doing hydrogen powered cars. One is, as I just described, an FCEV, which is a fuel cell electric vehicle, where the fuel cell charges the battery and the battery makes the wheels go around. The other sort is an HICE, a hydrogen internal combustion engine, where if you know what you're doing, I absolutely don't, you can modify the workings of a petrol engine, normal petrol engine, and have a little switch on the dashboard. So when you flick it, there's a sort of poof out the back of the exhaust pipe, and a cloud of steam comes out, and you're now running on hydrogen. It's very cool. Apart from that, there's no detectable way of doing it, apart from you're now producing steam out the back rather than all those nasty hydrocarbons that we get when we burn petrol.
And which of those approaches is more efficient or effective?
That's a really good question. And they, because an internal combustion engine produces a lot of heat before it can actually do anything useful, my guess is that the fuel cell electric vehicle will be more efficient, because the much more of the electricity is turned into wheels going round by the electric motor, which is 90-something% efficient. However, you've got the inefficiency of the fuel cell converting the hydrogen into electricity, which is about 50-ish% at the moment, which might sound bad, but actually isn't much worse than the efficiency of burning coal to make electricity in a power station. So it's sort of swings and roundabouts.
Okay, and how likely is it to explode?
My favourite question. So it's possible to explode. It's a very flammable gas, and anyone who's made hydrogen in the chemistry lab at school will know the squeaky pop that you use to discover hydrogen. But in a vehicle, in fact, and the people who make these vehicles are very keen to point this out, petrol is far more dangerous, because when it catches fire, it goes down and across and then burns. So it basically burns everything in a radius around the car, whereas hydrogen goes boom, straight up in the air. So there is an explosion, but it all vents upwards because hydrogen is such a light gas. So the explosion is actually far less devastating than the equivalent of petrol.
Okay, and so it doesn't worry you having the high pressure 10 litre tiny little things?
No, it doesn't worry me in the slightest. I'll happily carry this in my pocket. It's got a regulated valve, which keeps it completely closed it's an extremely thick-walled vessel, so you'd have to damage it really severely in order for anything, the gas to come out. And even if you put the regulator on and accidentally leave the tube unattached, you get this gentle hissing sound of hydrogen coming out. And I think it would just be a gentle squeaky pop if that were to catch fire, but as long as you don't have any naked flames nearby, then I think it's all quite safe. Yeah, I'm very comfortable using it.
So what sort of obstacles are there to this becoming a more widely used source of energy?
So mainly the cost of the equipment at this point. So electrolyzers, technology is expensive to build because they're not really haven't got the volumes and haven't really pushed the science far enough forward to make it a highly scalable technology yet. And the fuel cells are still quite expensive. The other problem is actually storing hydrogen. It's such a small molecule, it's really hard to keep it in anything. So it tends to leak out through the walls of most vessels and most pipes. So it's actually quite difficult to store it for long periods of time. So I guess the theory is that these cylinders will eventually go flat and kind of empty themselves. But I haven't had any problem with that at all. I actually use some very sensitive weighing scales to know how full the sticks are, because a full one with 10 litres of hydrogen weighs 0.9 grams more than it does when it's empty. So I've got these little scales that measure to a hundredth of a gram, which I got for 10 quid off eBay, which I can then use to say what percentage full the hydrogen sticks are.
Okay. So have you blogged about this or anything? Is there anywhere people could go to see a picture of this if they've not seen it in person?
So there's quite a lot of twit pics flying around of the hashtag HiPi if you search on that. But at the dog camp, the Raspberry Pi Foundation folks were there, and they've asked me to guest blog on their the Raspberry Pi blog. So watch this space for a public blog on the subject.
So in the meantime, look for #HiPi, which is HYPI. Okay, well, thank you very much. That was very interesting. And we're interested to see what happens next.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
It's time for some command line love.
You've got a sore throat there, Tony.
Yeah, thank you.
What's this then?
This one has been stolen from @CLIMagic on the Twitter. It's interesting because TAR, the famous compression and
archiving
tool, mm-hmm. Yeah, the tape archiving tool, you now can save one letter by not having to specify the compression algorithm that it uses. So TAR will now automatically detect the compression algorithm.
So wait a minute.
If you're expanding.
My muscle memory makes me like TAR ZXVF every time.
Yeah.
I even sometimes put the minus sign in front.
Ooh, I never do that.
Retro. Mm. Yes, so now you don't need to put the Z, which is obviously if you're using a zip archive, or the other character, which is if you've got a J for BZ2 compression. So you don't need to put that anymore. It'll work it out for itself.
Yeah,
hooray, automation.
It's going to take me longer now because I'm going to sit there thinking, now, which of those letters is it that I don't need?
Yeah.
Actually, this has been the case for years.
It's X for extract, V for verbose, F for file, so it's the other one.
Yeah. But there isn't there a what's it called?
A GUI app which does it for you?
No, an XKCD.
Diffusing the bomb.
Yeah, diffusing a bomb. You have to type in a TAR command correctly the first time with no mistakes.
Ooh.
Yes. I always get that wrong. I should use a GUI. But yes, I'm pretty sure this has been the case with GNU TAR for some time, because I think it's at least been 4 years that this has been the case. The reason I say that is because I've been at Canonical 3 years, and I remember telling someone this at my previous place of work, and they didn't believe me, and I had to prove it.
And you still, long, you still type the Z?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I am a putz, and I still type it.
Well, lots of people clearly don't know this because they are continuing to erroneously add an extra keystroke. So even if it's slightly older news, we still save those people a valuable keystroke.
Yeah, okay.
In this week's Command Line Love.
Command Line Love. It's now time for your feedback. Nige, via email, wrote in to say...
Your story about the bloke hacking a printer to make it run a game was of mild passing interest, but that was about it. However, I later realised that something about the story was familiar. Then I remembered that it was Richard Stallman trying to hack a printer, which was the very origin of the free software movement. It would be interesting to delve back into the history of computing over the last 20 or 30 years to look at the origins of today's commonplace technologies. We'd find that Apple didn't invent the tablet, Microsoft didn't invent the GUI, Google didn't invent internet search engines, and so on.
Mm.
He's right, you know.
Yeah, and there, I've got a couple of like retro books at home. Obviously, not read them.
Yeah,
but retro, mostly looking back over the history of computer games, like one that's retrospective of like every game ever, and you should play all these thousand games. But another one is a retrospective of one particular software house, and one's a retrospective of Sinclair. I would be interested in a book about the retrospective of, you know, computing in general from like the 1960s onwards. I think that could be an interesting series. There's little snippets you get. There's a channel on YouTube called Computer File, Computer Phile. And there's loads of professors and scientific experts and computing experts who pontificate about this is why things are like this and this is why this algorithm is like this. And it's quite interesting to watch. Be good in book form. Someone should do that. Or tell us if there is that book that I just don't know about it because I'm a clueless idiot.
And you can buy it and not read it.
You have a Kindle, don't you?
No, I have a Nook.
So what do you do with your Nook?
I read a book.
On your Nook?
I just keep reading the one book over it. It's the instruction manual.
I thought you were going to say the dictionary.
You just can't put it down. Next up, feedback. Laura.
Why, oh, why, oh, why, oh,
why? Who's this from?
Aldo Nogueira. Why does the BBC never recommend Linux?
That's a good question. Aldo, please pontificate further on this subject.
Tell us more.
An interesting phenomenon is happening these days. No one cares to put the latest security flaw found in Windows on the newspaper. It's old news, but Heartbleed and Shellshock are the minds of every person interested in technology. This may give the impression to the general public that open source is dangerous. We know that it's not true. Bugs are found much faster in open source software than in proprietary systems, and this is the only effective measure against hackers and malware fix bugs. What happened to the BBC? Are they biased? Are they paid to write conclusions biased pro-Windows and against Linux, or is it just naive view that a large company like Microsoft with thousands of employees must be better than a bunch of crazy hippies around the world? He'd like to know what we think. I have two thoughts.
Go on, then.
The first is, I don't know why the BBC as opposed to the media... No, I have three things. I don't know why the BBC...
three things.
I don't know why the BBC in... as opposed to any other media. I don't think that's any different. And in fact, the BBC does talk about Ubuntu sometimes on the website, at least. Yes.
And in fact, the BBC shouldn't be recommending anything at all.
No, exactly. Though they do recommend Macs quite often without meaning to. But they... I don't think that it... can't remember what I was going to say.
Okay.
Well, the other one was, I sort of do agree, because I did listen to a podcast the other day where they were talking about how they'd be a bit wary of using open source because of all these bugs, and I was sort of shouting at the radio. But yeah.
I think there's an element of unknown because, you know, there isn't the big brouhaha about Windows viruses, maybe because we're so fatigued at the fact that there are just so many of them. And they've been going on for so long that this is an unusual event for Heartbleed and Shellshock are both quite unusual, really.
Also, the thing I was going to say, actually, I remembered, was that it affects servers.
Right. So it will, you could be super safe at home with your Windows PC switched off, but your photos that are on, you know, some remote server could be affected.
Yeah. When you connect to your bank account,
right.
And it hits a lot.
Yes. Or when you're using, all of your social media sites, which are running on Linux.
Mm-hmm. And you've got all the network servers that just do networky things and stuff. Yeah, so I guess it's quite dangerous.
People don't really care that someone else's Windows PC is affected by something. But when the service that you use on Tinternet is affected, it's something you should worry about. Yeah, true.
Super Engineer is listening live and comments in the IRC channel that he thinks it's because the BBC use Windows. I suspect, being a media organisation, that a lot of them will be using Macs. Yeah.
I think it depends. It depends which bit. The BBC is so big.
True.
There's chunks of it that do use Macs, and we've had emails from people who work at the BBC and tell us they use Ubuntu. So it's not one big lump that all use the same thing.
And even then, I don't think that what people are using on their desktops would necessarily affect the news reporting angle. No.
And the server choice, I suppose.
I mean, I do get where he's coming from, especially the crazy hippies around the world thing, because I berated Rory Ketherlin Jones years ago when Windows 7 came out, or Windows Vista, I think it was Windows 7. And at the same time, a release of Ubuntu came out.
And at the same time, a release of OS X came out.
Right, and he mentioned Ubuntu as being made by a bunch of people in their kids in their bedroom kind of thing. Yeah. And I went a bit nuts and blogged about it.
But some of us are adults in their bedroom.
Exactly. Yes, I sit in my lounge.
And he's fairly careful about mentioning Ubuntu now.
Yeah, I think he got burnt then.
Yeah.
Moving on, Brian Walton emailed in to say...
Well, he had a long list of feedback about technical issues with the last couple of episodes, and, Mark?
He said, would you consider a part of the new section rounding up what is happening in various distros / flavours, maybe choosing one per week and detailing what has happened since last time? I use Ubuntu Studio, and my children use Ubuntu on their netbooks with Cairo Dock instead of the panel. Unity is too heavy for their machines, so pure Ubuntu is unsuitable. I wonder whether reviewing such configurations, an individual setup, might be useful show feature. It may help listeners consider alternative setups or configurations they had not previously considered. I am just writing, as I think here, in response to your request for show content ideas. Jingle really getting quite irksome.
Don't know what he means.
Yes, I do. So, yes, we take on board your super feedback about the technical issues, and we're working to fix those. Your call is important to us, etc. it's tricky because in order to do a distro review justice, you kind of have to use it. And I don't think I want to switch my main machine to another distro or another desktop for any considerable amount of time, just because it will break my workflow, and I'm a busy man, busy. These books won't read themselves.
I'm just not that interested in distributions anymore. It just works. I don't.
Yeah, there's some of that. I mean, I did buy a cheapo ThinkPad in order to test out Ubuntu Mate Remix.
Yes,
and I have been using Mate on that, but it's not my main machine, so I don't get to see what the warts and all are of daily use. I don't know if someone wanted to contribute a review of some kind.
I don't wish to sort of promote other podcasts too heavily, but on Linux Unplugged guys over at Jupiter Broadcasting doing something like this, where they get members, like contributors to the show, to actually review properly, use properly a distro, and then
if we're gonna pimp other podcasts, Linux Luddites is another one for that, especially for distros and desktops that are lean and lightweight, because they're very anti-modern desktops and distros. That's part of the strap line. Yeah, is that they are Luddites. They don't really like the new stuff. So,
You want to hear reviews of the latest episodes of Doctor Who, try the Doctor Who podcast. Are we not just pimping random podcasts? Oh, no, okay.
And there's Hesley FM.
Okay.
Moving on.
Computer Mike says he's been working with Ubuntu Quickly, building an ebook authoring and packaging system. He's made a YouTube video of it, which he has given us a link to.
And we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, so thanks for that, Computer Mike. It looks quite cool.
Yes.
And Javier Vaquez, I'll say, just in case that's right, says...
Just wanted to send a quick note to thank you all for your show. Your work's inspiring, funny. These are the bits I normally edit out because it makes us look big-headed.
I noticed you didn't include your radio crush.
My radio crush?
You didn't. You must have seen that email.
No.
Oh.
Oh.
Oh, Alan's pointing at the clock. Oh. We better get on.
Read
with it.
Quicker.
Yes.
So everybody brings a unique perspective, and the result is real teamwork. There's always something to learn from each episode, and I've been listening for a few years now.
I'm sorry.
Started when I did my first install on 1104 with zero experience. Now I'm running 1404 on my home desktop and on two laptops. Everything works great, wireless printer, tether shooting with my DSLR, and so on.
Ooh.
Anyway, there are still many things to learn, but your show is usually my first reference when I need to start looking deeper on the Ubuntu knowledge path.
Oh, thanks, Heavy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sorry for butchering your name. I feel bad.
So what was the other one?
No, there isn't time for any more. Move on. That's the end of your feedback.
Play the music.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that entertains, engages, or enrages you, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. Please do get in touch. I mean it. Just one message, just to know there's someone out there who cares.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. The next live show will be on Wednesday, the 15th of October at 8:30 in the evening PM time.
Super stuff. And that's when it gets all super confusing because the one after that is the one where time changes.
We go back to UTC.
No, after we record those two.
We go back to UTC.
We go back to GMT.
Just keep an eye on the website. It tells you.
Are we all here next time?
No, I'm not. I'm on holiday, so I'll be listening to you from a beach.
Excellent. Have fun. Bye-bye.
Bye.